strange visitors from another planet who came to Earth with powers and geek abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Yes, it's The Film File, the film show for film geeks by film geeks. Hello and welcome. It's The Film File with me, Lee Ford.
And me, Andy Meakin.
So there
almost
you
forgot
go.
My name then.
Did you? I thought that was a dramatic pause you were putting in. I didn't realise you were searching for your own name.
You're tired, are you? It's one of them.
I'm always tired.
Every episode is always like, I'm tired. I'm sure the audience out there are getting fed up with this. But this is because we always record on a Sunday and I tend to work Saturday nights. And I can't sleep after I get home from work. So it's usually 4 a.m. by the time I finally shut my eyes and doze off. And have a restless night. But I'm okay. I'm on good spirits.
Well, that's good.
I'm walking a lot more at the moment. I'm getting some daily exercise in a lot more. So I'm feeling a bit more full of life. I mean, admittedly, the reason why I'm walking a lot more recently is I'm addicted to Pokemon Go again.
Oh, that'll be it then. There is truth behind your madness.
I'm heading into work very early so I can walk around the city centre capturing gyms, capturing Pokemon. And there's loads of events going on at the moment in Pokemon Go. And yesterday, for example, there was a big event that started at 2 o'clock and I didn't start work until 4. So I got into town in time for 2, went to the cathedral because there's always something going on there. And the masses of people with their phones out capturing these gyms was hilarious. But it's a great community because like I just walked up to like a couple who were stood there who were in their mid 50s and just went like, guess you're here for the gyms? And they went, yeah, we've got our route planned out and we're going to be doing this. And I was just having a good chat with them. And it's like, it's just bonding with complete strangers who all of us should be too old to play these silly games. But we're all just absolutely loving it. And like I say, I mean, it's getting me out of the house. It's getting me walking more. I'm looking out the window at the moment and it's quite nice today, although there's some clouds on the horizon. I'm hoping it stays because I'm planning for a nice long walk later. Gaming, get your exercise. Who'd have thunk it?
That's interesting because I might have something that plays into your gaming that is my neat thing this week. I'll reveal all as the show reaches the neat thing bit.
I mean, regularly Lee does reveal all, and I have to edit it when I do the YouTube videos because I don't think we can put that out there. But
which brings us nicely to a social challenge.
I'm not sure how that's going to fit.
I don't know how it works, but we'll give it a go. We'll make a move. Last week we asked on our social challenge, what were your favorite needle drops? Songs that become iconic, that don't just add a bit of background, but add something integral to the story itself, whether it's something we feel about the character, something that is thematic to the rest of the film, that when you think about that song, you can't help but think about that particular film. So Andy, how did we do? What have we got?
We got a fair few responses. Some people had multiple answers.
That was me as well.
To the degree that I don't think we'll be able to cover everyone's full answers, but what I have done, and I will put this in the show notes and I'll also pop it on the socials when the show goes live, I've started compiling all the answers into a Spotify playlist so that everyone will be able to listen through all these and see if they can recall what films they remember seeing it in. Most of them will be straightforward. We'll start over at Mastodon, and we mentioned it on the show, but Lust for Life from Trainspotting was mentioned by Rollo Treadway on Mastodon, because come on, as soon as you hear that dum 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 dum, you just see Renton running down the road.
That
is intrinsically linked to that film. Provoking Cats on Mastodon, another one that's intrinsically linked. Stuck in the Middle with You for Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, of course.
Which, as I've said, you know, hearing that track makes me want to cut someone's ear off. Salty Red Popcorn, love this answer because I had this on my list for exactly the same reasons. For me, it will always be Bad Moon Rising and American Werewolf in London. Such a perfect blend of music and movie magic. And it made me a Creedence fan for life. Yes, thrice yes. John, UK film nerd. Bit of a cheat, but the song Super Moves by Overseer will always be associated with The Matrix for me. I first heard it in the Super Bowl trailer when we had our very first look at Matrix Reloaded, and then it went on to become synonymous with the Animatrix. Yeah, I mean, the Matrix films have loads of like key iconic needle drops in there.
Yeah, I mentioned Propeller Heads as part of that as well. I can't ever hear that piece of music without the ensuing gun battle. And it stuck. It's one of those pieces of music that is absolutely entwined with the action.
Lee Christopher Leary over on Facebook said Mizzaloo, the opening credits of Taxi. Bizarrely, yeah. Most people would go for Pulp Fiction for that track, but he would choose the French version of Taxi. But he's a huge fan of the French version of Taxi. He absolutely loves that film.
It is fun.
Lindsay Story, I've got loads. Come and Get Your Love in Guardians Volume 1. Wasn't expecting that. Thunderstruck in Deadpool 2 is a good one. Immigrant Song in Ragnarok sets the mood for battle. White Room at the end of Joker. Love that one. And the slow close-up to Robert De Niro in Goodfellas with Sunshine of Your Love. Playing also the bit when all the dead bodies are turning up, which she said the piano tune, I think it's called Layla. Yes. Derek and the Dominoes.
It is.
Layla.
I think I put that on my list as well.
Full 7.5-minute version. And since you mentioned Lust for Life in Trainspotting, which came to mind straight away, I'm going to go for Born Slippy. Ange replied with Led Zeppelin's Immigrant Song in Shrek 3. See, Immigrant Song has been in so many films that everyone's got a film that they associate Immigrant Song with. The scene in which Snow White instructs all the woodland animals to attack the castle and all the princesses follow suit. Just perfect. Yeah. I'm not a huge lover of Shrek 3, but you put Immigrant Song into any film and I am in. That's it. That's the one scene that will stand out and draw me in. On my own point of view for Immigrant Song, I really love the Atticus Ross and Cavanaugh version from Girl with a Dragon Tattoo. That is,
yeah, I've got that version. It's good.
I think it's a really good version. Owen Cooper. Owen Cooper jumped the gun. He didn't wait for us to post the question of the week out. He answered as soon as the podcast dropped. So he clearly just got to that and went, pause, need to get these out of my head. And he started off saying, before I forget my answers for this question, I'll put them in here. I think the best needle drop has to go to Donnie Darko's head over heels scene. Yeah. They're starting at the school bus, following them through the school, introducing all the characters without dialogue to such a degree that you know everything. Yeah, every time I hear that song, that song play out, I think of that scene as well. So great choice. That long shot is one of my all-time favorites. I think you can take almost any Scorsese needle drop, especially the famous one in Mean Streets where Robert De Niro's character enters the scene, which was Jumping Jack Flash.
Ah, of course.
The opening credits to Watchmen is also great. Yeah, Times They Are Changing by Bob Dylan. Great use of a song. One of the only Zack Snyder films that are worth watching. Be careful because you might get a whole list from me over this week. He then added on a bit later on in the week, Free Bird in Kingsman, Hey in the Suicide Squad, Don't Stop Me Now in Shaun of the Dead, and Brie Larson's cover of Black Sheep in Scott Pilgrim. Then over on Twitter, you dropped in a huge chunk of yours.
Good, because I can't remember. I was possessed at that particular time by inspiration to go all of these great songs.
So you dropped in Peter Gabriel, In Your Eyes, Say Anything, The Velvet Underground and Nico These Days, Royal Tenenbaums, Baby Driver, Bell Bottoms. You beat me to the punch on that one. That was mine. That was mine, Bell Bottoms.
We'll share.
Sharer, not carer. The Sound of Silence, Simon Garfunkel, The Graduate. Phil Collins, In the Air Tonight from Miami Vice. Yeah. Derek and the Dominoes, Layla from Goodfellas. It's so perfect. Tequila from Pee Wee's Big Adventure. Tiny Dancer, Almost Famous. Twist and Shout, Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Now, I need to preface my answers here by saying that at work, I set up a playlist for just needle drops to play in the foyer.
Oh, very good.
And it's about 8.5 hours long. Because as I've said many times before, I love a good needle drop. So I've cherry-picked a few of my favourites. Rubber Biscuit by The Chips and Be My Baby by The Ronettes from Mean Streets. Rubber Biscuit, which is the drunken party scene with the camera like rigged, strapped to... Can't listen to that track without seeing Harvey Keitel in close-up, staggering and then falling over. Where Is My Mind from Fight Club? We mentioned when we did our deep dive of Fight Club. Judy as a Punk from Royal Tenenbaums by the Ramones.
Great soundtrack album.
Goody Two Shoes by Adam Ant for the opening of Hot Fuzz, where the story of Nick Angel is getting regaled. Angel, Massive Attack. I need to say Angel by Massive Attack from Snatch. It's also used beautifully in the Flight of the Phoenix remake from the early 2000s on the scene when the Raiders attack them. It's an average film, but that scene is just wonderful. Eloise by Barry Ryan from Last Night in Soho, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Film that not many people have actually seen. And I always say, look, if you've seen Paul Blart Mall Cop, you need to have watched Observe and Report and realise what a better film that one is. That used Over Under Sideways Down by the Yardbirds in a marvellous sequence where they're taking multiple drugs. And it just is forever etched, that track, to someone doing drugs. Chick Habit from Death Proof by Bound. Bad to the Bone by George Thorogood, Terminator 2.
Oh, I was going to say the beginning of Christine.
But for me, it's got to be like Arnie stepping out of that bar, like with his sunglasses on. Like, da-da-da-da-da-da, marvellous. And then a more recent one, Harder Than You Think by Public Enemy for End of Watch. I could go on for the next 3 days with my list here, but they're the ones that generally stand out for me. I love a good needle drop, and there's so many. Even one of the films that I'm reviewing this week had a marvellous needle drop. It was a De La Soul track, of course. It's a marvellous needle drop that now, every time that I hear that track, I'm going to remember the scenes that I saw it in.
So this week's deep dive question, and thank you, of course, to everybody who responded to last week's, and there's some fantastic answers.
Feel free to keep responding, guys, as well.
Yeah. We'll call them out at some later date.
I will keep adding them onto the Spotify playlist. So it'll be, I might set that as an open playlist for others to contribute to.
Yes.
So that we can slowly see over time more and more needle drops get added in there. I love music, I love film, I love the combination of the two, and I'll happily sit on a bus and listen through anyone's suggestions.
But this week's question, we're going somewhere very different. It might be a tricky one, so bear with us. And it's a what if. Now, stay with me. What if Star Wars wasn't a big success and Damnation Alley had been the big sci-fi movie that summer?
What if David Lynch was actually the director of Return of the Jedi?
What if Bill Murray had been cast as Batman instead of Michael Keaton? You get the gist? Send through your favourite what-ifs and a little explanation of what you think would have happened if those what-ifs had worked. Look forward to hearing your responses. I know it's a different one, but it's one we've been thinking about for a couple of weeks and very interested to know what you think would have happened. Anyway, you know how to do it. And if you don't, we're going to tell you.
All you have to do, head over to the social media channels, follow us, Filmfile UK. We'll post the question out on there and respond via there. Or you can email us in, podcast@filmfile.uk. Or if you're on Spotify, you can answer via the show notes, the questions down there, answer via there. We'll read out your answers on next week's show. Very interested to see what kind of bites we get on this one.
Yeah, I know it's a tricky one. Normally when we've done tricky ones, we don't get a great response. So we're leaving it to you, but what ifs? How things would have changed cinematic history by change of casting or a filmmaker going in a different direction? We've all heard the stories of directors fired. What would have happened if they'd stayed on the set? That kind of thing. But moving on to this week's show, what have we got for you? Well, we have a deep dive into the Stephen King adaptation of Misery. We have reviews of...
Both myself and Lee got to see The First Omen this week, and we will definitely be sharing some thoughts on that one later in the show. And then I've got a chance to see Back to Black, the Amy Winehouse biopic, and also film that we've both been looking forward to, Civil War, that landed at cinemas this week.
Before that, we've got the news and we've got the box office. So, Andy, is it Civil War at the box office, or is Godzilla X Kong still doing remarkable monster business? Let me know.
So over in the US, Civil War opened in the top spots, 25.7 million. Godzilla X Kong held into second place with 15.5 million. Ghostbusters Frozen Empire in third place with 5.8 million. Kung Fu Panda 4, 5.5 million for fourth place. And Dune Part 2, still in the top five, 4.3 million added onto its total. Here in the UK, it's Back to Black that shot into the top spots, taking 2.7 million. Kung Fu Panda 4 in second place with 1.8 million. Civil War into third place, 1.6 million. Godzilla X Kong takes fourth place, 1.2 million, and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire, 787,000. Frozen Empire has just clipped 160 million worldwide, which, given it had a budget of 100 million, means that it's a long way off being considered a profitable film. Dune Part 2 is trekking towards 700 million. It's on 683 million worldwide. A very strong success for this second part of the Dune series of films. So Civil War, I mean, it's one of the highest budgeted A24 releases to date, costing 50 million to make. It looks like by the end of this first week, it will have made back that money and be heading quite nicely towards a profit line. But as we always say, it's all down to whether it's top heavy and it has a huge drop off next week. But Godzilla X Kong is still doing great business in the background. And so it should come as no surprise to anyone at all that the Monarchverse is continuing forwards, particularly. And this one pleases me because I might be getting to the stage that I might be checking out on the films. But Apple TV has announced that Monarch Legacy of Monsters has been renewed for season two.
Yeah, I saw that. And when I saw it, I thought of you, Andy, because I know you, as I was, a big, big fan of the series. Do we know if Kurt Russell's returning? Has it been mentioned yet? Or are they going to go in a completely different direction? What do we know? Do we know anything at this stage?
We don't know anything at this stage. I imagine there'll be some of the cast will be returning, but whether Kurt Russell himself is going to be coming back, and Wyatt, obviously, we don't know. It might even jump into different parts of the timeline and focus on new other characters in the present and past. We don't know. We know nothing about what they're going to do with it. But what we do know is that as part of the new deal with Legendary Entertainment, Apple are also planning multiple spin-off series based on the Monsterverse franchise. So it's not just Monarch coming back. It's getting expanded out into other avenues.
Yeah, we both enjoyed the series. And we both enjoyed the series in the same way that we both felt let down by the last film, which there was no character development. This was all about world building, character building with the monsters always present, but not always visible. I think it was a great series. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it took chances, especially with the casting ideas. Can't wait to see what they do with season two. Let's hope, though, that Kurt Russell comes back, because Kurt Russell just adds Kurt Russellness to everything that he's in. Back in 2022, we announced that Edgar Wright was in talks to direct a reboot, remake, a new version of The Running Man. Originally, a film that starred Arnold Schwarzenegger, directed by Paul Michael Glazer, he of Starsky and Hutch fame, based on, well, a Stephen King story, but under King's pseudonym of Richard Bachman. It didn't stay particularly close to the novel, but we hear that Edgar Wright has now moved forward and has found a leading man, and that leading man is Top Gun Maverick's Glenn Powell.
Yeah, Glenn Powell's really on a rise to success at the moment because he was also in the recent rom-com Anyone But You, and he seems to be popping up everywhere. This version of the story will be apparently drawing from the novel. It's not going to have anything to do with the Arnie version. The novel that was penned under the name Richard Bachman, set in 2025 in America under a totalitarian regime that uses violent game shows to placate the disenfranchised masses. And one desperate man who needs money for his sick daughter joins the most popular show in which teams of killers hunt down contestants. The longer one survives, the more money that person makes. The 1987 film with Arnie. It's one of those films that's actually quite bad, but Arnie carries it through. You know, with all his like, hey, light bulb, Christmas tree. It always makes me chuckle. I find fun with it, but it's not as bad as an adaptation as Lawnmower Man was. Let's be honest here. But it has
no resemblance at all in any way to King's short story.
I'm very excited because I do like Edgar Wright. I've got confidence that he will tap into the novel really well and give us something that is befitting of the King name.
So following the news from a couple of months ago that Alex Garland, who we'll be talking about later with Civil War, and Danny Boyle are reuniting to breathe new, if not infected life, back into 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later film series. And they're thinking of, well, developing a brand new trilogy. So we've guessed that Danny Boyle will be doing the first film, but it seems they have found a director for the second film. And that is Candyman's and the MCU's Marvel's director, Nia DaCosta.
Yes, this is really good news because I loved what she did with Candyman. She also did Little Woods as well. But she's been in talks to direct the second film of the trilogy, which suggests to me that they want to make each of these films have a slightly different feel. So it's not just three films of exactly the same approach. Yes, Danny Boyle and Alex Garland start in the first one, but then let others continue the story. But hopefully it doesn't go down a Star Wars routes and the Nia DaCosta comes in and throws everything Danny Boyle did out the window, do a home thing, and then Danny Boyle comes back and scrambles to try to put it back together. No, I've got more confidence with this.
So not to concern you with that, Andy, but Alex Garland is writing the whole trilogy. They're just going to switch out directors for each film.
I mean, I know that Garland said that he's not going to direct again, but wouldn't it be great if he actually came back to direct the third one?
You never know. He didn't say he's never, ever going to direct.
He just said that he's kind of done with it for the moment. We do know already with this, the original film star Cillian Murphy is set to executive produce and is rumoured to be starring in at least the first of them. I couldn't be more excited for a project. Having Boyle and Garland working together is just magic. And to see what they do with this trilogy, I'm hoping it finds an audience in a modern age, because we're seeing a lot of older properties that were popular being brought back and not finding the audience. I'm looking at you, Exorcist Believer, last year. And as reported on the box office last week, we're also looking at you, First Omen. But hopefully 28 Days Later franchise can come back and can still thrill people with a zombie mayhem.
No release dates in mind yet, but it seems as though production will start sometime during this year.
So CinemaCon took place over this past week, and
we
could do a whole 14-hour show talking about everything that went on there, because it was a whole week of talks, promotions, selling of films, showcasing. What I've decided to do is cherry pick out some of the top things that have got our interest. Let's start with what Paramount brought to the table in this, because they did a really good showcase with footage from some of their upcoming projects and slated release dates. The biggest event that they had was they showed 5 minutes of unfinished footage from Ridley Scott's Gladiator sequel, which showed the far more elaborate games within the Colosseum, including the floor being flooded enough to not only have boats, but also sharks.
I'm sure you're going to say this, Andy, but Paramount have confirmed a Star Trek origin movie is officially in development.
And going ahead apparently sooner than what we thought. British TV director Toby Haynes, who gave us Andor and Black Mirror episodes, has been set to direct this new theatrical release film in the series. They also confirmed that Strange New Worlds has been renewed for an additional season. But at the same time, Lower Decks is going to end at the end of its fifth season.
They give and they take away.
There was footage shown from Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which has confirmed all those rumours and speculation that Jim Carrey's Dr. Robotnik is back and he's going to be making an impact again. Smile 2 had footage shown, which saw Naomi Scott playing a pop star who becomes the target of the smiling demon. And Quiet Place Day 1 showed off footage conveying the much bigger scale of this film compared to the main series. The main series has always focused on just a small group of people in one location. This is going to be huge. It's going to focus on multiple groups across a wider area. That hits only in June 28th. It's only a couple of months away. Smile 2 arrives in October this year. Gladiator 2 opens in November, and Sonic the Hedgehog 3 runs into December this year.
Over at Fox, we had footage from Alien Romulus, which features facehuggers, chest bursting, and plenty of gore. And while there's no footage online, they are saying this looks horrific and bloody.
TMNT is getting another film, this time an R-rated, more adult-focused Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film, adapting the Last Ronin story. And that is, the miniseries, The Last Ronin, was dark, mature story unfolding in a future where all but one of the Ninja Turtles is dead. New York City's battle-ravaged wasteland, and the lone surviving turtle embarks on a seemingly hopeless mission, seeking justice for the family that he lost. It's a magnificent miniseries. It would adapt perfectly. It's basically the Logan of the TMNT world.
Yeah, I was about to say that, actually. Or the Dark Knight.
And we were kind of teased it in Transformers Rise of the Beasts, with the final shots of it showing that the G.I. Joes are getting brought into that franchise. Well, it's been confirmed that there is going to be a G.I. Joe and Transformers team-up movie. This is an idea based on the 1980s comic book series that was published by Marvel, but then other publishers in recent years have picked it up and moved forwards with it. The two properties have generally been thought to exist as independent franchises, but seems though Paramount have got them both under their belt. They might as well mash them both together and hopefully get more of a success than what they've had in recent years with either property.
First reactions have teased a breathtaking and disturbing remake of Nosferatu, which you and I can't wait to see.
Lionsgate had its presentation, and they launched with footage from the upcoming Michael Jackson biopic named Michael, which stars Jackson's real-life nephew, Jafar Jackson, as Michael, along with Coleman Domingo, Nia Long, and Miles Teller. They also showcased some ballerina footage, the spin-off of John Wick, that we know has been pushed back to next year now. The glimpses that they saw also confirmed the return of Keanu Reeves in this film. Now, it doesn't mean that it's set after John Wick, so it might not. He might still be considered dead as per that franchise, because we know that Ballerina is going to play across a time frame that is set before the events of the most recent John Wick film. Mel Gibson directed Flight Risk. A trailer was shown for that. There was some more footage from the Borderlands movie, with Eli Roth revealing that Blanchett wanted to do the movie because of her love for John Carpenter's Escape from New York. I'm not sure how that connects, but hey, let's see.
And we get the return of the Magicians in Now You See Me 3, which I thoroughly enjoyed the first one. And you know what? I actually enjoyed the second one an awful lot as well.
Yeah, they're quite fun. And thankfully, all four of the original cast are going to be returning. Eisenberg, Franco, good. Harrelson, and Fisher.
Oh, good. We got Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes footage and reactions from that, as well as
Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who are two names that always spark our interest. They have Project Hail Mary, which stars Ryan Gosling, and that's due out in 2025. Gosling plays a man who wakes from a coma afflicted with amnesia and soon remembers that he was sent 12 light years away from Earth to save humanity. Bill Skarsgård's reboot of The Crow has now been pushed back a couple of months. It's now coming out in August this year, not in June, which means that it'll take on Zoe Kravitz's thriller Blink Twice, that releases around the same time. This move is probably more to do with the fact that Sony's Bad Boys Ride or Die decided to muscle in to take The Crow's original release date. The next Saw film has been pushed back another year. It's going to be coming out September the 26th, 2025, instead of this September. And Alexandra Aya's Never Let Go, which stars Halle Berry, will have the September 27th release date all to itself.
Calm down, fanboys, because reaction from Daredevil and Wolverine footage, we saw Wade Wilson bring R-rated raunch to the MCU. You can relax. It's not being Disney-fied. Captain America 4 footage, Harrison Ford wants Sam Wilson to rebuild the Avengers.
Lots of Marvel clips were shown in their showcase. With the Captain America footage, there's a scene that was shown that shows Thunderbolt Ross telling Sam Wilson, just do your job, you're not Steve Rogers.
Oh, brutal.
Also, we know that Thunderbolts is now being retitled Thunderbolts Asterix, and apparently the reason for the Asterix won't be discussed until after the film's release. And the Fantastic Four film is going to reportedly be fully filmed with IMAX theatres in mind, so they're going for that big showcase approach. But the main event for Marvel clearly was going to be Deadpool versus Wolverine. Feige saying, it's effing amazing. I'm allowed to say that now because it's R-rated. The film's director, Sean Levy, was on hand and said that the movie was built for audience joy, and he brought along 9 minutes of spoiler-free footage for the crowd, which is apparently pretty much the first 9 minutes of the film. They didn't want to drop anything from later in the film. We haven't got confirmation on the rumoured cameos that are out there, but let's be honest, everyone's just excited for this because everyone loves Deadpool. Let's be honest, there's no one out there who doesn't enjoy a Deadpool movie. On the subject of superheroes, I never saw this one coming. But Tim Kring's 2006 superhero drama Heroes is set for another revival. Yeah.
This is the second revival? Am I adding that right?
There was Heroes Reborn in 2015, the limited series, but it didn't quite find an audience. And Heroes, I remember when Heroes first started, everyone was on Heroes. That first season was fantastic. But then second season onwards, it just kind of meandered and lost interest. Maybe because some of the show's writers like Brian Fuller moved on to other projects. And without that core group, it just became a muddled mess of ideas.
Right.
Kring wants to bring it back for Heroes Eclipsed. Amusingly, they announced this on the same day of the solar eclipse earlier this week.
Ah, clever.
I thought it was a great little bit of a tie-in. This version of the show is now envisioned as an ongoing series. It's been pitched to NBC along with streamers, and it's likely to be aiming to recapture the magic that the first season had, which turned it into a must-see cultural event of the time. I'm interested enough in this because even on the later seasons, when it got weaker, there were moments of absolute comic book genius within there, and the cast was still always likable and engaging.
Was the second season where one of the characters went back to feudal Japan?
Yes.
I think I was out by then, because I'd seen everything in the X-Men with the Future Days run, and it felt we were going into that territory, and I thought this is very recognizable territory for me. I've been in this sort of ground before, because I've been reading comics since forever.
That's one of the things that I thought that it did well at the start, Heroes, because everything, even in the season one, that it was like, you know, it just felt fresh and original. It wasn't really, if you'd read comic books, because you could saw the echoes of things that you'd seen done, but it riffed on them. Whereas the second season onwards, it just became a bit too carbon copy rather than being its own entity, riffing on ideas. Fingers crossed, this will come back well. Another thing that is coming back, will it come back well? Blair Witch.
Blumhouse, they're involved with this attempt to bring back the old Blair Witch herself.
Yeah, Blumhouse and Lionsgate have teamed up for a multi-film deal that will see the latter horror and thriller genre label reimagining as Lionsgate IP.
Well, we saw what they did with The Exorcist, Andy, so...
Yeah, I'm hoping that Lionsgate have a bit more influence this time than what Blumhouse are churning out. This is the first title that they're announcing in their multi-film deal. It's a project that has had a mixed history. The very first Blair Witch caught people off guard with its found footage realism that, particularly on its US release, people still believed was real by the time it hit the screens. By the time it came out over here, we knew it wasn't. I've got a lot of love for it. And then there was the awful Blair Witch 2 Book of Shadows, which had nothing to do with any of the first film. And in recent years, we've had the kind of reboot sequel in 2016 that I've got some love for, but it was just treading the similar ground.
Didn't hate it.
I'm interested to see if they can actually do anything with the Blair Witch franchise. I'm more interested to see whether Lionsgate working with Blumhouse will stop Blumhouse on this downward spiral trajectory that they've been churning out in the past few years and get them back to being the studio that you look to for good horror product. Small bit of pinch of salt news. Jurassic Park franchise, as we know, is progressing. The current rumours that to add into the pinch of salt is that it's going to be titled Jurassic City. And Dev Patel, yes, he of Monkey Man, is rumoured to be targeted to be leading the cast alongside Scarlett Johansson. Like I say, it's a pinch of salt, might not be true. Dev Patel is obviously a big name at the moment, might just be people jumping on the back of there. But let's see.
Well, we've had a few trailer drops this week. We had James McAvoy in Speak No Evil. We had Daisy Ridley is in Deep Water as she swims the channel in Young Woman and the Sea. And the biggest drop, I think, this week is Joker Folie et Doux, which unites Joaquin Phoenix and Lady Gaga as the Joker and Harley Quinn, respectively.
This is so far removed from the DC Joker. It's its own entity. It's very teasing, this trailer. It looks like they're both in the asylum and they break out. But do they break out or is this all imagined? It looks like La La Land on weird drugs. I wasn't utterly convinced that we needed another Joker film.
I've got to agree with you on that one. I didn't think it needed a sequel. I thought it was a complete film.
But it looks like it's something unique enough to be worthy of coming along. Very interested in this. There was also the Maxine trailer. As you know, I'm a huge fan of Ty West's X.
Need to catch up with the second one.
This was enough to make me go, you know what? Mia Goth's going to be part of my life again in a couple of months. Can't wait for that one. We've also got another trailer for Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which is all about the legend of Caesar. I don't need any more apes trailers because I'm already in.
Yep.
I did catch last week the trailer for Bambi the Reckoning.
I was hoping you wouldn't, Andy, because I know it would upset you.
Which is from those people who gave us the Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey films. And it looks dreadful.
Well, I'm surprised you're surprised.
I'm not surprised. I'm just upset at myself because I'm going to end up watching it. There's a load of other trailers out there, but they're the ones that caught our eye because, like I said, it's CinemaCon over this past week in Vegas and a lot of footage is starting to drip feed out over all the channels.
But folks, that's the news. You're listening to The Film File, the film show for film geeks by film geeks. And if you haven't already subscribed, please do so by heading over to your favorite podcast platform, leaving a like, and remember to hit that subscription button. You can get in touch with us by
social media channels, Filmfile UK. We're mostly prominent on Facebook, Twitter, Mastodon, and Blue Sky. Or you can email us podcast@filmfile.uk. Love to hear from you. Love to hear thoughts on film.
And now it's time for this week's deep dive. This week, we're going to be talking about the 1991 American psychological horror thriller directed by Rob Reiner, based on the 1987 novel by Stephen King. And we are talking Misery.
I'm your number one fan. I'll take good care of you. My name is Annie Wilkes.
I guess it was kind of a miracle you finding me.
In a way, I was following you.
You were following me.
I think one of my clients, Paul Sheldon, might be in some kind of trouble.
Eventually, you'll come to accept the idea of being here.
Annie, whatever you think I'm not doing, please don't do it.
Trust me.
God's sake.
It's for the best.
Misery. After a car accident, acclaimed novelist Paul Sheldon is rescued by Annie Wilkes, a nurse who claims to be his biggest fan. However, it all goes to hell and becomes a living nightmare. As Paul recuperates in her house, Annie discovers that the lead character in his books, Misery, has been killed off. And things go from pretty terrible to absolutely awful. The film stars James Caan as Paul Sheldon, Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes. And this is the first Stephen King novel to win an Oscar. And King himself has stated that Misery is one of his top 10 favorite film adaptations. It was a huge success, received positive reviews from Columbia Pictures, and was a box office success, with Bates' performance in particular drawing widespread praise from critics and an Academy Award for Best Actress at the 63rd Academy Awards. Just before we started recording this, I said to Andy, when did this come out? I can't believe it was 1991.
Yes.
This film still has an absolute impact. I'd read the book prior to see the film, so I knew the plot. But I think Rob Reiner, a little bit like Frank Darabont, is one of those directors who works in King's universe and keeps the essence of King, even though they might change elements, and there's a massive element change in the film from book. But they keep the heart of Stephen King in it. And that's why I think their adaptations are always successful.
Released in the UK, May 1991. It did release in the US at the back end of 1990. Yes, there were days when we had to wait 6 months for things to come out in the UK. I knew that this was going to be 1991 because I got to see this 18 rated film because I was 18.
Oh, right. Well, that's a good way to recognize it there.
That's how I knew, because I saw this on the big screen. Me and my mates went along to see it because we're all big Stephen King's fans. I'd read this book beforehand, they hadn't. And I remember when we saw it, I came out of it just wanting to go straight back in and watch it again because it was just Stephen King perfection. I would rank this potentially as my favourite Stephen King adaptation.
Oh, really?
I love Stephen King. I mean, I love Stephen King in general, but I love him more when he's not tapping into supernatural, but he's tapping into the horror of humanity. And this, for me, was one of his books that tapped into that because it drew on King's own worry that he would have a stalker fan out there who would manage to capture him and torture him into writing the perfect story just for them. And Rob Reiner and William Goldman, let's not forget that this is a William Goldman script, absolutely tap into that book and adapt it almost 100% perfect. There's only a few small changes. There's one change that some people say is quite major, and that's in the hobbling moment. But I think it works so much better the way that he's hobbled on film. It's just one of those slow-burning, tension-mounted films that starts off as, you know, he's been saved by Annie Wilkes after he's crashed his vehicle in the snow. And she's a bubbly, excitable, very giddy fan who's taking care of him. And like, oh, the phones are down, but I've told your agent, once the roads are clear, we'll be able to sort something out. But it's after she reads his latest book and she gets to the end. I mean, as she's reading it, she keeps coming into Paul and showing excitement. So like, oh, is he going to, oh, what's going to happen? What's going to happen? When it flipped, the film flips is after she's read the final chapter of his most recent book and he's killed off the character that she loves and has even named her pet pig after. And the filmmaking technique suddenly becomes a lot more claustrophobic because even though it's set mostly within the house, it feels quite open. It's well lit, sunlight beaming through. But as soon as she steps into that room, calling him a dirty bird, you dirty, dirty bird, everything suddenly becomes very tense. And from that point in this film, I was palpitations. Even watching it this week, like I've said before, there's films that you've watched so many times that you can just kind of watch them and they're on in the background and you don't get drawn into them, but you know what's happening because you've already seen it. As soon as I was watching this, that was my only attention because it's just a masterclass in everything coming together perfectly. Perfect screenplay by William Goldman.
The perfect screenwriter.
Yeah. And perfect casting with James Caan and Kathy Bates.
Let's talk about this because while the film is taut and it is frightening, it's basically it's two-hander between the two lead characters. Now, casting, well, originally Sheldon was offered to William Hurt, Kevin Kline, Michael Douglas, Harrison Ford, Robert De Niro, Pacino, Richard Dreyfuss, Gene Hackman, Redford, but they all turned it down. Warren Beatty was at one point interested, but filming on Dick Tracy ran over. And then someone suggested James Caan, who agreed to play the part, and with Caan commenting that he was attracted to how Paul Sheldon was a role unlike any other that's been played. He's a totally reactionary character. He's not the tough guy. He is trapped for the majority of the film. And it's a film about emasculation. And you needed the perfect Annie to be able to deliver that isolated terror. Angelica Houston and Bette Midler were both offered the role. Midler would later say that she deeply regretted the decision, but it was William Goldman who suggested that Kathy Bates, then a relative unknown, should portray Annie Wilkes. And the rest really is film history. It is a genuinely horrific, at times funny performance in the way that it's written. She sometimes plays it very, very broad, but there's that twinkle in the eye, that cold twinkle, that something horrific will happen. And that's what makes the film work. It's the rising tension because the audience are generally one step ahead in this film.
Yeah. Caan and Bates had very different approaches to acting, and it caused a bit of tension on set. Caan is very much, he believes in rehearsing as little as possible and just drawing on the moment and improvising around. Whereas Bates, coming from a theatre background, was very used to practicing and rehearsing and getting everything right before you start shooting. At one point, she turned around to Rob Reiner and said that Caan was not attempting to relate or listen to her to come to some compromise. And Reiner smartly just said, use that frustration and play that back at him. And that's how she gets that frustration at the character, that she's frustrated because he's told the wrong story. She drew upon her own frustrations towards how Caan was replying to her. And I think it really does make it work well. The relationship might be strained between the two actors, but that's how it should be for those two characters. I did read that Caan turned up hungover for one day of filming, and all of the scenes that were shot that day were completely unusable. But Reiner had told Caan that there was a problem in the lab and it hadn't developed properly, so that he didn't, like, you know, kind of make the actor feel guilty. But Caan learned a few days later that it wasn't anything to do with the labs and offered his own money to cover the lost money to the studio. Caan was...
He was a legend, wasn't he?
He's a legend, consummate professional who just cared about what he was delivering, cared about, like, the whole project around him. Even when you look at the minor casting, because even though this is mostly just these two people, it would be too much if there was no one else there, because, like I say, the tension building in that household built and built and built, and you could potentially have a heart attack out of the tension. But they pack it out, the cast, with characters such like Buster and Virginia, played by Richard Farnsworth and Frances Sternhagen. Buster being the local sheriff law enforcer who is kind of piecing together what's happened to Paul Sheldon. And those little bits and moments where it flips over to him and his laid-back, cool, calm, but very investigative nature, and his rather oversexed, aging wife, who is constantly flirting with him, even though she's his deputy, they add some comic relief at much-needed junctures in the film, and they are just so charming. And you grow to love them only for typical King fashion to play out.
I think we can guess what happens. Yeah, the great Frances Sternhagen, one of my all-time favourite actresses. She's brilliant. Of course, as you mentioned earlier, Andy, a lot of fans were upset by the removal of one of the key sequences. And William Goldman actually wanted to keep it in. And that is when Annie Wilkes severs one of Paul Sheldon's feet with an axe. Goldman apparently loved the scene and argued for it to be included. But Reiner insisted that it changed to her breaking his ankles. And then Goldman came round, subsequently wrote that this was the correct decision, as the visual depiction of an amputation would cause the audience to actually hate Annie instead of actually empathizing with her and her trauma and her madness. This is near on perfect film with my all-time favorite screenwriter. How could it not be? And Rob Reiner, who has proved time and time again that he can turn his hand to almost any genre. He has that dexterity as a director to be able to play in every field and does it so well. This film is considered to be a classic for many reasons, and understandably so. It plays with all the tricks of tension and fear, but at the heart of it, it is about two people who are suffering in very, very different ways. And due to fantastic performances, the building of tension, the film is incredibly taut. It works. And while it might not be my favorite King adaptation, I'm looking at you, Dead Zone, it's certainly up there as one of the best Stephen King adaptations so far.
We mentioned earlier in the show, as our question of the week, about needle drops in films. And there's Liberace's rendition of Moonlight Sonata will never be heard the same way because it was used marvelously over the hobbling scene in this. The whole use of Liberace music, who'd have ever thought that Liberace would suddenly become part of a soundtrack of a film? Because I never did. But it's Annie Wilkes has a fascination with the music of him. So it's used perfectly in the background throughout some of the key moments in this film. But that hobbling scene, everything about that hobbling scene is just built up perfectly. From Moonlight Sonata playing, you straight away know that something's not right. She's going to do something here. Right up to the swinging of the hammer and saying, "I love you, Paul." And James Caan's reactions. James Caan playing someone in crippling pain. It's just perfect acting class. You genuinely believe that she's took at his ankle with that hammer. And the prosthetic effects that they use for it, it still makes me basically crease up squirming on that scene. As it's it hits, it's everything in that scene is just built to perfection because it slowly builds up to you know something's going to happen. And then when it happens, it's perfect filmmaking from a really good story by Stephen King. Perfectly adapted to the screen.
If you want to see this perfect screen adaptation, Andy, where can you find it?
You can currently see it as part of the MGM subscription via Amazon Prime. So if you subscribe to that or get the 7-day trial while you've still got it there as an offer, or just go out and buy it on DVD, Blu-ray, whatever format you want to get it on. I think I've still got it on VHS somewhere.
We'll be back next week with another deep dive. And now it's time for this week's reviews. Andy and I have seen a film together. Andy has seen a film that I want to watch, and I'm sure Andy has seen thousands of other things. Andy, where do you want to start?
I'll start off with the film of the week, and I'll start off by talking about Civil War.
This place is so weird. It's a twilight zone.
Are you guys aware there's like a pretty huge civil war going on?
Sure.
Look at the tops of the buildings.
We're just passing through. We're American.
What kind of American are you?
We're going to D.C. before anyone else does. That's the job.
Go. You're so close.
Civil War. Written and directed by Alex Garland, Civil War is set in the near future, and we're thrown into an America that's been at war with itself for an unspecified amount of years. A war that looks like it might be drawing to a close. California and Texas, for some undisclosed reason, joined forces to form the Western Forces, declaring internal war on the loyalist states that support the sitting president who's in his third term in office. The film focuses on renowned war photographer Lee Smith, played by Kirsten Dunst, who's planning to travel to Washington, D.C. with her colleague Joel, played by Wagner Moura, to interview the president. Knowing full well that the closer that they get to the Capitol, the more dangerous it'll be for them, as the president has turned the nation against the press and they're seen as enemies of the states. They take with them their mentor, veteran journalist Sammy, their always excellent Stephen McKinley Henderson, and aspiring young war photographer Jesse, played by Kaylee Spaney, who Lee is initially reluctant to have with them. As they travel across the states, they have short encounters in a few locations that the film uses to portray the different ways in which the everyday citizens have responded to the conflicts present around them. The smart thing about this film is that there isn't any hint as to what politics led to this civil war. We don't know whether the sitting president represents right or left-leaning parties, nor do we know what sparked the conflict. Having California and Texas combine to oppose the left and the right together further cements that this isn't a film about politics, but it is a film about war and what it does to the individual. Even the people that Lee and her team encounter along the journey are ambiguous as to what side they are actually on, or if they are even on any side at all, or just using the situation to exhibit some of their own darker natures. With the focus on war correspondence, we are, just as they are, observers to the horrific nature of humanity across this broken landscape road trip. Dunst as Lee starts the film cold and emotionless. Her years of shooting the horrific side of humanity without involvement have stripped her away of compassion for anything aside from the perfect shot. On the flip side, Spaney as Jesse finds it hard to disconnect from the sights that she witnesses, swiftly getting emotional when presented with the worst sides of humanity. However, over the course of the film, the two start to change, with Lee gaining her emotional connection again, whilst Jesse begins becoming colder. This exploration of journalism and disconnect offers a fascinating and compelling depth to the group, with their colleagues offering the sagely advice or exuberant enthusiasm that the central pair lack. Civil War is a messed up road trip through a broken America. And whilst it doesn't take sides nor push an agenda, it does serve to warn us of where we could be if things go a little sideways politically at any point. And it does proffer up the question as to what would you do if the country around you suddenly started turning on itself? Would you take sides? Would you try to stay neutral? Or would you seek the opportunities that it presents through the chaos? In breaking open the United States, Garland has broken open humanity itself to shine a spotlight on who we are.
You know, Andy, I'm disappointed for many reasons. I couldn't make the screening with you. It wasn't quite a Godzilla X Kong scenario, but yeah. Something cropped up and I'm gutted because I really, really want to see this film. And I've done quite a bit of research in advance of seeing it. And what I really like is the take that Garland has been very careful where to point the finger at political parties, and especially with the idea of ultra-liberal California and ultra-right-wing Texas being joined in this particular war. So I think it sounds a clever film even without seeing it.
It is a smart move for him to keep it apolitical. The important story is a fractured country and how it affects the people who aren't necessarily directly caught up in that conflict, but are impacted by it. I think for our next film, we should go on to First Omen.
We kind of both went into this with a little bit of, is this going to be any good? We read very mixed reports, some calling it incredibly good, some calling it pretty poor. Some just saying it was a solid film. But you and I, well, we weren't so sure, were we?
You must be very careful, Margaret. Bad things will start to happen. Evil things.
It's all you know. Don't.
The First Omen. I believe the girl is to be the mother.
Mother of what?
Is the most terrifying.
666. It's the mark of the devil.
Movie of the year.
It's not real. It's not real.
What's not real?
Who said that?
The First Omen.
So a young woman starts to question her own faith when she uncovers a terrifying conspiracy to bring about the birth of evil incarnate in Rome in 1971. We don't ever like to be negative, I think, here at the Film File. We always talked about positivity in films and always try to find something good. And there are good things in this film, even though right from the get-go, let's just say, we both didn't like it.
When we say there's good things in this film, at a push, I'd say there's two good things. The first is the lead actress, Nell Tiger Free, who throws herself pretty much literally at some points into the role. She is magnificent from start to finish, even though she's working with some of the worst material that I've ever seen displayed on screen. You can't fault her at all. And you've got the opening scene. I'll start off by saying that this film, as it started up, and the camera work with sweeping and zooms looked very 70s aesthetic. And I thought, oh, they've actually got it right. You have a setup moment with Charles Dance that felt like The Omen. It had the usual, like, the Omen films always, when they do the deaths, they kind of signpost in advance. It's like, because even on the original Omen, there was the sheet of glass that flies off the truck. We'd seen the truck. We'd seen the glass getting loaded. You know what's going to happen, in the same way that the Final Destination films do. And so it kind of does this with like some stained glass windows getting put in a church, but they're dangling precariously. And you're like, I know what's going to happen here at some point. And it introduces the setup for the film in such a good way. Unfortunately, as soon as that setup finished, the rest of the film rapidly spiraled downhill for me. And the point at which I basically went, okay, you've lost me completely now. I'm going to find everything at fault with this film from this point onwards, was about half an hour in, when there was a completely unnecessary nightclub scene shoehorned in that had the biggest issue for me. I could be nitpicky when it comes to things being set in a certain time period and they get a small detail wrong. But this nightclub scene, set in 1971, has people with late 70s fashions dancing on the floor to disco music, which didn't start up until later in the 70s, and particularly Boney M's Daddy Cool, which was released, I believe, in June 1976. It was their second release, so you can't even say that, oh, they recorded it 5 years earlier. And it was at that point that I was like, the filmmakers haven't done any research into the time period of history that they're setting this in. They clearly think that the audience are so dumb that they're not going to notice it. And if you've got disdain for me as a filmmaker, I'm going to have disdain for you as a member of the audience. And from that point onwards, I hated everything in this film.
Yeah, let's just talk about that, because that is a key element, because the film is set in 1971. And hey, I think that director, in her first big screen outing, she's a TV director, Arkasha Stevenson, has done a generally good job. And you know, the use of zoom lenses and the color palettes all have that incredible 1970s look. However, the original Omen was set in the late 70s, 76, 77, around the time of when the film came out. This film's set in 1971. Now, that's quite a big jump in story logic, just to get that element wrong. I mean, there are a couple of elements which it gets wrong, but that I found befuddling, because it's just a typo. Just put 1976 on it, and then you wouldn't have had the disco sequence feeling out of place. You wouldn't have everybody going, yeah, but the original film. So there was that kind of element that sort of confused me. I do think that Arkasha Stevenson brings a great look to the film. I think it's far more artful looking than it had any right to be. And I think it doesn't feel like one of those which is visually a cheap ripoff. I think the film's got a very great, good look. And she does tackle elements of body horror. And I'm not blaming the director for this film. I think it's a studio thing. Mm. Hey, for me, this is not the worst Omen film. I know you and I talked about it. There is the remake, and there is the incredibly cheapo gender swap TV version, Omen 4: The Awakening, which is just purely horrific for the wrong reasons. But I don't know. I couldn't connect to this film. I thought Nell Tiger-Free was brilliant in the lead role, very convincing, and she managed to juggle that innocence with the awakening horror. But it's the script which lets it down. Visually, I think it's a great-looking film. I can't knock that. It's by the numbers, and I was literally looking at my phone time to see when you were going to tick off the next horror bit. And it did that a very, very annoying thing of being quiet, quiet. Very, very loud, with lots of stabby music and screeching
choruses.
Yeah, and then it went very quiet again, and it got on my nerves. And at that point, that was me out, because I didn't need that. There were elements that I thought were nicely shocking, and there were some good throwbacks. Yes, you had the opening sequence that you've mentioned. There was the replay of this time a nun hanging herself and throwing herself out of a window where you had the nanny in the first film do it, but now she's on fire. I just thought it was just a poor attempt. As I said, for me, not the worst out of the Omen films, but it had that effect on me more than anything else. I found it dull and uninvolving.
As long-term listeners to the show will know, back in episode 129, we spoke of our love of the original Omen film, which meant that when this was getting pitched and promoted as being a prequel to that film, and seeing some of the positive reviews saying it fits perfectly, it made me think, maybe this is for me, maybe I'm going to enjoy it. But I'm not sure whether people have seen the same film as I did, because this does not fit perfectly with that original Omen film. There's the line from the original Omen film, his mother was a jackal.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, she clearly wasn't, according to this. And this is one of the big fundamental issues that I have, is that this film, if this had been a reboot of The Omen and not been promoted and pitched as being a direct prequel to Richard Donner's original film, it might have worked better as its own product. I still probably wouldn't have loved it as much as some people are, but I wouldn't have this dislike of how it's not part of it. It doesn't feel like it should be part of the same series. You mentioned the It's All For You moment, which, whilst visually was just like a little nod and reference and makes you go, ah, yeah, but it makes no sense in this film.
Yeah.
In the original Omen film, that was Mrs. Baylock had come along and needed to become Damien's nanny. And so the original nanny needs to be out the way. And so she is psychically convinced to kill herself because it's all for you, Damien, so he can be brought up as the Antichrist by Baylock. In this, what was it for? It's all
effect.
For who exactly?
And yeah, it's for effect.
It was a red herring, because at that point you're supposed to believe that this other girl is potentially going to be the mother of the Antichrist. And you think that, oh, it's so that she can look after her. We don't like to drop spoilers, but let's be honest, it's not a huge spoiler, is it? Because this film thinks it has a huge plot twist in the last act. It's literally as it reveals it. It's as though the filmmakers are going, hey, 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 you didn't see this coming. It's the most obvious plot twist of all time, that within the first 5 minutes of the film, you will go, oh, yeah, I know where this is going, and I know everything that's going on here.
Just one thing that I mentioned after we'd seen it, and I'm going to sort of correct myself on it, and just after doing a little bit of reading up on it, and this idea of religious fanaticism, which runs through the center of the film. So while it's not explored in any detail, and I'm still, without giving anything away, think it's a bit hokey, I do think it draws quite interesting parallels to sort of God-fearing fundamentalism that's happening, especially in the US at the moment, where the idea that the church wanted to bring about apocalypse, I'm talking in the real world, not just the film world, which gave it a little bit more credence. And I think that's underdeveloped and could have been, it now made sense to me the more I thought about it and the more I sort of read up on it afterwards. But I think it was a bit of a missed opportunity and could really, really, rather than being dialed back, more could have been done with this idea of religious fundamentalism, even though it didn't quite sit with me.
Yeah, I get that. The deaths in the Omen films have always been quite shocking, but they've never felt gratuitously abhorrent. And I feel in this, there was too much lingering on unnecessary imagery that cheapened the overall effect. Did we really need to see a demon entity crawling out of a woman's vagina in such detail? I don't think so. Did we really need to see such body horror in gruesome detail? I don't think so. I think it just lessened it. And I mean, how many jump scares were there where it was just simply character standing middle of frame and someone suddenly appears behind them and goes, oh, didn't mean to scare you?
That was unnecessary. That cheapened it.
It lost me quite early on in this film, and it was a chore to sit through the rest of it. Me and Lee watched this together, and I'm aware when Lee's not enjoying a film. I was tempted at multiple points to say, shall we just give this up and leave? But I like to stick things through to the end regardless.
Yeah, yeah.
So I forced myself to sit through it. I mean, Lee actually did say at the start, is like, because this is late, if we're not liking it, should we switch it off after 45 minutes? It was like, no, I want to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, Lee, I made you sit through the whole lot of the film.
No, it's okay. And I would have hated myself for walking out. I've walked out of two films, and one I didn't want to, and one I needed to.
I've heard from a few people who've gone to see it and felt the same way, that Immaculate tells pretty much the same story, and that's slightly better. So if you want going to see one nun film this year, watch Immaculate with Sydney Sweeney.
And for me, while it's not the worst Omen film, I'm looking at, well, everything past Richard Donner's fantastic original. I think what I'm more interested in is seeing what Stevenson can do on her next project, and hopefully it's not another Omen film, because I think she has talent as a director, and I'd like to see her with a better script and see what she does with that.
And so we move from my worst reviewed film so far this year to a bit of a surprise for me, because I seem to be enjoying the next one more than a lot of other people, and that's the Amy Winehouse biopic, Back to Black.
Amy. I want people to hear my voice.
The album's number one around the world.
Yeah, that's my girl.
I need to live my song. I've got to make something good out of something bad.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Sam Taylor-Johnson's biopic of the singer Amy Winehouse, whose meteoric rise to stardom was then hit with tragedy as addictions led to a far too early passing from this world, doesn't offer much insight into the singer that we didn't already know. And it may offer a pretty diluted and sanitized version of events, but that didn't prevent me from finding enjoyment in watching it play out. Amy Winehouse's love for music and singing came from her nan Cynthia and her dad Mitch, with a particular love of jazz which fed into her musical style. Picked up by Simon Fuller's 19 Management, her first album Frank propelled her into stardom, and the follow-up album Back to Black cemented her as an icon in the industry, whilst her outspoken attitude and personal life captured the attentions of the press, seeking a story to splash across their front pages. In amongst the turmoil, she found the love of her life in Blake Fielder Civil, a love that would, according to the press, initiate the start of her tragic downfall. This film attempts to recontextualize that love story as the core element of Amy's story, and in doing so, humanizes Blake, a person whose character has been demonized by the press throughout the years, and makes us understand why he meant so much to Amy. In the casting, Marissa Arbella looks the part. She has the swagger, she's got a spark of humor, and she can certainly lend her voice to some iconic tunes. She inhabits the presence of Amy Winehouse well enough to draw you in and make you care for the life being presented on screen. Jack O'Connell plays Blake as all charm and smarm, and he's shown as a troubled addict who, contrary to how the gutter press in the UK showed him, didn't engineer Amy's downfall or drag her kicking and screaming down with him in a spiral of drugs and loutish behaviour. Instead, he's lent a flawed human approach here, and whilst his cheeky chappy nature may still rub some folk up the wrong way, it's easy to see how Amy and him gelled so well. Eddie Marson is a welcome addition to the cast as Mitch Winehouse, Amy's father, who supports her musical career whilst, as any father would, despairing at some of the life decisions that she makes. The overall sympathetic approach to Amy's life is certainly a welcome take after many years of tabloid sensationalising of the singer's life, but it also offers far too generic approach at the same time. Much like Bohemian Rhapsody, it is stripped of any real depth. Facts are glossed over, and whilst you can't help but tap your toes at some of the wonderfully belted out tunes, you don't feel that you've actually learned anything about Winehouse's life of any value or substance. Sticking to the biopic formula, the overall effect is a film that entertains while watching, but feels somewhat lacking along the way. But I did enjoy this a lot more than I expected, possibly because I watched the first Omen before it, and so anything would seem better after that experience. If you want a film with more insight into Amy Winehouse, then the 2015 documentary Amy is where you should be looking. If, however, you just want a simple glossary of the singer's life, which is well acted and presented, then Back to Black is worth a shot.
I'm not drawn to it. I've seen the documentary. I've seen the documentary several times as I teach it as part of film studies, and I think it's a brilliant way of being an objective biography of a talent that was sadly taken away from us far too young. Anyway, that's the reviews for this week. What have we got coming up over the next week?
So at cinemas, we've got, and I've been looking forward to this one, Abigail. Hopefully that's some horror that will really entice us. It's Radio Silence. We're both fans of Radio Silence.
We are.
Butterfly Tale releases. Swede Caroline, which is a British mock documentary about marrow farming. The Book of Clarence, and Sometimes I Think About Dying. over on LTV and Sky. I quite enjoyed this. Now you can get a chance to check it out. BlackBerry releases this week. And Relax, I'm From the Future releases. Amazon have Going Home with Tyler Cameron. And over on Netflix, oh, come on, we are both going to enjoy hating this film. Rebel Moon Part 2, The Scargiver.
It's come around so soon, hasn't it?
I will be watching The Scargiver. I'm not sure whether Lee's going to bother.
I'll watch it, you know. I will watch it. Maybe not in time for next week, but I will watch it.
You've got to build yourself up to it.
I'm just not that drawn. As I said to you, I thought the trailer was boring. So, yeah.
But yeah, it's a packed week at cinemas in particular. I'm hoping to see Swede, Caroline and Abigail. And sometimes I think about dying, at least. But it might be a show next week where we have to cherry pick which reviews we go for.
Well, we'll wait and see for next week. And that brings us to the end of this week. But before we go, let's tell you about our neat things. The stuff that we've enjoyed over the last week. Andy, what have you enjoyed over the last week?
After multiple seasons, it finally came to an end. Curb Your Enthusiasm closed off its final ever season in the perfect Larry David Curb way. Now, Curb has always been a mixed bag, and you're either a huge fan of it or you just don't get it. But I've been a huge fan right from the start. And even on the more muddled and average episodes, I've kind of got why they're like that. And it's because of the way that they make it. There's a lot of improvisation done. It does feel very amateurish at times. It originally started off feeling like a fly on the wall, kind of like following Larry David around, but it became a bit more embellished over time. And this season has been, as usual, a bit of a mixed bag. There's been really good episodes, or there's been really bad episodes with just one or two good moments in. But I've enjoyed them because there's something about Larry David that I just can't help but love. And it got to the finale, and I didn't know where they were going to go with the finale. And they've used it to not only wrap up Curb in its perfect way, but also to kind of apologize for upsetting all the Seinfeld fans with how that ended by referencing the final episode of Seinfeld in a perfect way. Jerry Seinfeld turns up in this final episode. There's a court case going on. He's behind bars. It's similar to Seinfeld as to how that ended. But then they get out of it and they finish by saying, we maybe should have used that on Seinfeld. It was a great closing episode for what I have enjoyed every time that there's been a new announcement of New Curb. I have been excited. I've been on this ride since day one. It's sad to see him end, but it's also good to see him end on the right note. Curb Your Enthusiasm has been a great show from start to finish.
My neat thing for this week, entirely different, because that's how we roll over here at the Film File. Mine was a visit with the family during the Easter holidays to the Sheffield Video Game Museum, the UK's only museum that's dedicated solely to video games, with a mission to collect and preserve and exhibit old video games for everyone, and keep them forever. It's located in Sheffield City Centre. If you want to go and check it out, and trust me, you should, because it has over 100 playable exhibits, from retro arcade machines to modern up-to-date games. It's family friendly, which was great. It allowed both myself and the other half to play games, and it allowed the kiddo to get lost in games. And we found crossovers with me playing games that I would never have ever played, and going back to my childhood and finding things like Space Invaders and the original Pac-Man. Oh, I loved these so much. A great fun, expertly curated, with some great displays, spans 50 years of video game history, well worth a day out. You book in and you've got 3 hours just to go around everything, and it is so much fun. So my neat thing this week is the Sheffield Video Game Museum, and I implore you, give it a go.
Great place to visit. If you love video games of any era, great place to visit. Going there just reminds me that I want to go to some retro gaming conventions again, because that's a whole weekend of just doing that, going around playing games and also seeing creators of the games doing talks, etc. Retro gaming community is my home.
And that's us done for this week. Thank you, as ever, for joining us here at the Film File. And as ever, please tell your friends, tell anyone who's interested in films to follow us, like us, subscribe to us. Andy, any plans for this week?
Catching up on TV shows, because, man, is it just me or is everything landed at the same time?
It has. It's a busy week.
Oh, it's Pac-Man. You've been talking about retro games and I've just said Pac-Man.
I finished Silo on your recommendation. Just started on Ripley, which we'll talk about at some point. Fallout later today. Yeah, busy time on TV. No time for movies, but I will see you hopefully this week for a movie.
And late news just landed today that Silo might be shooting seasons 3 and 4 back to back.
Yeah, season 2's in the can. So hopefully we'll be seeing that before the end of the year, because it left on one heck of a cliffhanger. We'll see you guys next week for another film file. But in the meantime, Andy, I'm your number one fan. There's nothing to worry about. You're going to do just fine. I'll take good care of you.